Diplomacy is a lost art these days. In this age of brutal honesty, which usually is more brutal than it is honest, carefully worded phrases spoken tactfully seem to be a thing of the past. This reminds me of a story. Some of you have probably heard this before, but it just fits in so well. As a young man was hired to work in a produce department at a grocery store. On his first day of work, he is working out in the produce, and a little old lady comes up and says, "Young man, I'd like to buy half a head of lettuce." He looks at her and says, "Ma'am, I'm sorry, we don't sell half heads of lettuce." She says, "Young man, I want a half a head of lettuce." So he goes back, he goes through the swinging doors that go back to the back of the produce section, calls out to the boss, "Hey, Mac, some crazy customer out here wants a half a head of lettuce." And out of the corner of his eye, he notices that she's right on his heels. And he quickly adds, "And this nice lady would like the other half." So Mac takes a head of lettuce, chops it in half, wraps it up in plastic. Man gives it to the old lady, who walks away with a smile. After she leaves, Mac says, "You handled yourself pretty good there." He says, "Well, where I come from, you kind of have to think fast on your feet." He said, "Oh, really? Where'd you come from?" He says, "I come from Detroit, city of ugly women and good hockey teams." Mac says, "Is that so? My wife's from Detroit." And just that fast, the young man said, "Oh, yeah, what team did she play for?" Now, the reason that I bring this up has to do with the text for today's message. And I'm glad that it worked out, and I must admit, I didn't plan it this way. I'm glad that it worked out that we had the King James Version read this morning of 1 Corinthians 13. We get to verse 5. Love is not easily provoked, or in some more modern translations, not easily angered. Now, that seems pretty straightforward enough until we dig a little deeper into the original language. You see, in the original Greek text, there is no word for easily. The word was added to the phrase. Paul actually wrote, so you wonder, where did the easily come in? And it is reported that the translators of the King James English put the word in themselves because King James had a temper. And they didn't want to offend him. So they tried to lighten the blow a little bit by saying, "Love is not easily provoked," hoping to keep their own heads. A little bit of diplomacy. But when we get to what Paul actually wrote, that word easily should be lifted out. You may notice on the back of your bulletins where we have the sermon outline, in the title, easily is in parentheses. That's why. It's not really there. We can't let ourselves off the hook quite that easily. And Paul himself was not immune from this problem. Now, Paul uses a Greek verb here when he says, "Love is not provoked." The noun form of that same Greek verb is found in the book of Acts. It is in Acts chapter 15. Now, to give you the background of this story, Barnabas and Paul were two of the early missionaries. They were sent out by the church at Antioch to go and to plant churches, which they did, first on the island of Cyprus, which was Barnabas' home territory, and then up into the land of what we know of as Galatia, which was close to Paul's homeland. Now, on this trip, they took with them a young man, maybe a teenager. He was a nephew of Barnabas, a man named John Mark. John Mark went with them when they ministered on Cyprus. Not sure, since he was a relative of Barnabas, maybe that was his home territory as well. Not sure of that, maybe. But we know that when they left Cyprus and they got to Galatia and they started in and the going got tough, John Mark got going. He left. He went back home. He said, "This ain't for me. I'm out of here." Paul and Barnabas completed their missionary journey. They went back, reported the success God had given them to the church at Antioch, went down to Jerusalem, dealt with some things there, came back to Antioch. And they have the idea, let's go back to those same churches we started, just make sure they're doing okay. Barnabas says, "That's a great idea. Why don't we take John Mark with us?" And Paul says, "Uh-uh. He's a quitter. He left us. I'm not dealing with that. We're just not going to have him." Barnabas said, "No, let's give him another chance. He's young, you know. He'll be all right. Let's give him another chance." Paul says, "No, we're not doing it." And the Bible tells us in Acts 15:39 that a sharp dispute or disagreement arose here. It's the same word that Paul uses when he says love does not get provoked. Well, Paul got provoked. And so did Barnabas. And they knocked heads to the point that Barnabas said, "Fine, I'm taking John Mark and I'm going back to Cyprus." Paul says, "Fine, I'll take Silas and we'll go back to Galatia." And the two never worked together again. So Paul is not immune to this issue when he writes that love is not provoked. Now, what do we mean by provoked or angry? I came across several definitions of anger in my study, but two really caught my attention. One says this: anger can most often be defined as an emotional response to a perceived wrong or injustice. An emotional response, and that's what anger is, it's an emotion, feeling, to a perceived wrong or injustice. Now, another defines anger this way: anger is a strong emotion of irritation or agitation that occurs when a personal need or expectation is not met. Now it gets a little more personal. And I'm sure that you have felt both sides of this, right? Maybe you're watching the evening news and a story comes on about how someone has victimized somebody else. Maybe it was an elderly person, or maybe it was a small child that couldn't really defend themselves. And what's your response? You get angry. And if it's to a dog, I really get angry. Right? Remember the story in the Old Testament about David? This is after his sordid affair with Bathsheba, and in order to cover it up, he has her husband killed, and he's got all these things that he thought he had nicely swept under the rug. And his prophet Nathan comes in and says, "I got a story for you. This rich man lived next to a poor man. The rich man had all kinds of flocks and herds. Poor man only had a little lamb. And that lamb was like a pet. I mean, it lived in the house. It slept with him. It was just like a pet. And one day, an unexpected guest came to the rich man's house. And instead of taking one of his flocks, he took that neighbor's pet lamb, slaughtered it, and served it to his guest." And you can just picture David. He's about to come out of his throne. And he says, "That man deserves to die." That's anger. That's that emotional response to injustice. And that wasn't even David's lamb. You know, it wasn't personal yet. Nathan turned it around and said, "You are the man." And then it got personal. But when we see something that's wrong, when we see something that is unjust, we respond emotionally. We're upset. But it also happens when that's personal. When there is a need we feel that is not met, when there's an expectation and somebody lets us down, what is our response? Oftentimes, it's a combination of hurt and anger. Now, that first definition that I mentioned is important because it shows that anger is not wrong in and of itself. I think it's wholly appropriate to respond in anger when we see injustice, when we see wrong. We're going to see that God has that emotion. But the second definition demonstrates how anger often drifts from legitimate to illegitimate, is when it becomes personal. As Leon Morris observes, there is a place for anger that is a passionate opposition to evil, not a selfish concern for one's own rights. And this is where I think Paul is making the distinction. He is not trying to suggest that all anger is inappropriate. The problem comes in when the anger becomes selfish. When the anger is based on selfish motives, selfish reasons, that's when it drifts into that category that Paul says love has nothing to do with, when it becomes personal. Well, this morning I want to deal with both sides of that. I want to look at the righteous side, but then also the flip side of that selfish, sinful side of anger that Paul says true love has nothing to do with. Let's begin by considering the acceptable reasons for righteous indignation. Maybe you've heard that phrase before, righteous indignation. The first time you heard it, did you really know what they were talking about? Indignation we don't use very much anymore, but it's another word for anger. I remember hearing people say in the past, oh, I'm good and angry. Okay, if you take that literally, that's what righteous indignation is, good and angry. And there are times when it is right to be angry. God gets angry. Jesus, when he lived on earth, got angry more than once. Paul says in Ephesians 4:26, in your anger, do not sin. Now, if anger was always wrong, he couldn't write that. It's easy in our anger to sin. We've got to be very careful about it. That's what he's warning against. Now, what do we mean by righteous indignation? Again, it is a reaction, a strong emotional reaction to a moral wrong that we witness. It means that we share God's opinion or feelings on the matter. I believe that we see anger as righteous in two circumstances. When God's glory is threatened or abused, we have the right to be angry about it. That's what Jesus did when he cleared the money changers out of the temple. God's glory was being threatened there. They were turning God's house into a marketplace. And in anger, he drove them out. And then also, when others' welfare is threatened or abused. And again, you see that as well. Jesus responded sometimes in anger when he saw other people, their welfare being threatened or abused. I want to add one last element to this, something that was really brought home this last week. I had a chance to talk to somebody who lost somebody close to them, and they said very honestly, I'm angry. I'm really upset. Why would God take this person? And what I was able to share with that individual is that God feels the same way. I believe death makes God angry. The Bible tells us that the last enemy to be defeated is death. You know what that says? Death is an enemy. Death is something God never intended when He created the world and when He created mankind. And when you read John chapter 11, when Lazarus died and Jesus comes to the tomb. Yeah, we know John 11:35, the shortest verse of the Bible, Jesus wept. Okay, we get that. But in the verses before that, the words used to describe Jesus is that He was provoked. Jesus was angry. Now, I've heard people say, yeah, He was angry at the people that were weeping and wailing. No, I don't think so. I believe Jesus was angry at death. Because death is the wage of sin. And sin has corrupted God's good creation. And I think God shares that feeling toward death. He hates it. He watched His Son endure it. And one day He is going to defeat it. So when we share God's opinion on those matters, that falls into the category of righteous indignation. And it's okay to feel strongly when we see God's glory being threatened, when we see other people being abused or threatened. It's a very appropriate response. Now, we got to be careful what we do with it. I'll get to that in a moment. But don't feel guilty about the feeling itself. I've heard some people say, oh, you're a Christian, you should never get angry. Really? Jesus was. He was good and angry. There are times when we can be as well. Think about how Jesus handled His anger, though. It's often different than ours. His anger was over the injustice, the unrighteousness that was manifested there at the temple, how people were getting greedy and exploiting other people in the name of God, so that it was bringing disrepute instead of glory to God's name. But you'll notice that Jesus' anger was never about His own stuff. It was never about His own agenda, His own schedule, His own rights, His own desires, His own preferences. So that's what our anger is almost always about. It's almost always personal, isn't it? It's about what someone's done to me. It's about what I don't get or what needs of mine aren't being met. We get angry. Jesus' anger was never personal. He never was defensive. Well, you say, what can we do about righteous anger? First and foremost, we need to pray. When an event or a situation makes us angry, we need to talk to God about it. Why does it make us angry? Does God feel the same way about it? You know, when somebody makes us angry, tell God on them. Go to your Heavenly Father and tell Him about it. One author put it this way, if you find yourself growing angry at someone, pray for him. Anger cannot live in an atmosphere of prayer. Now, one thing we're not to do, even with righteous anger, is to take matters into our own hands. The Bible is filled with examples of people who had the right to be angry, but what they did with that anger was not right, and they failed miserably. Moses was right to be angry because the Israelites kept complaining over and over and over. And they were complaining about God. They were questioning God. He was right to be angry about it, but he was wrong when he expressed that anger by striking the rock. And for that act of anger, he was denied entrance into the promised land. David's son Absalom was absolutely correct in being angry when his sister was raped. But he was absolutely wrong when he took matters into his own hands and murdered the rapist. That wasn't his place to do. Leviticus 19:18 says, "Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against one of your people, but love your neighbor as yourself." Paul quotes Deuteronomy and Proverbs when he writes in Romans 12, "Do not take revenge, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, 'It is mine to avenge, I will repay,' says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head." And then he concludes that paragraph, "Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." If I could paraphrase that old Greyhound commercial, leave the vengeance to God. Let him take care of it. He does a much better job than we do. James 1:20 tells us, "The anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God." Now, does this mean that if we see someone being attacked, that it's wrong to notify the authorities? Not at all. That's what we should do. That's the lawful thing to do. What I'm saying is, don't take matters into your own hands and do things that you don't have the right to do. And even when our anger is legitimate, even when it is righteous indignation, don't hold on to it. Earlier I mentioned in Ephesians 4:26, "In your anger do not sin." The remainder of that verse states, "Do not let the sun go down while you are still angry." In other words, deal with it. The sooner we bring our anger under control by addressing ourselves to the source, the better. Whether that's going to God with it and leaving it there, whether that's confronting the person, whether that's doing something within our rights about it, whatever it is, don't let the anger hold on in your life, because then it turns to bitterness. Even righteous anger can turn to bitterness if we don't deal with it. Now, unfortunately, much of the anger we deal with is not of the righteous variety. I've seen both men and women who are constantly irritated by other people, especially close family. The smallest error, a wrong look, a misplaced word, a simple oversight causes miniature explosions throughout the day. Or else all these trivial aggravations build up until there's a major eruption occurs. And that's usually over something very small. So how do we know if our anger is wrong? Let's return to the second of those two definitions of anger I mentioned earlier. Anger is a strong emotion of irritation that occurs when a need or an expectation is not met. It becomes personal. Anger is sinful when it is a resentful reaction to someone threatening our own personal wants and needs. Think about what James says in James 4. Verses 1 and 2. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Obviously they're there, so what's the cause? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You want something, but you don't get it. You kill and covet, but you can't have what you want. You quarrel and fight. So many times our anger, which expresses itself in fights and quarrels, stem from selfishness. We're looking out for number one. We're trying to defend ourselves. It's that smothering absorption with getting our own way, with having our needs met, being acknowledged, being understood, being listened to, being catered to. That's what usually brings us in conflict with others. People don't come through for us, and that makes us angry. And that anger can quickly turn into blind rage, cruelty, and even violence. So what are the annoying reasons for this reckless irritation? I've come up with four. Our personal perception is rejected. Our personal privileges are threatened. Our personal preferences are challenged. Or our personal plans are interrupted. Isn't that usually what makes us mad? We've got a schedule for today, but something or someone interrupts us. And, oh, it makes us mad, right? Or somebody does something and we're like, wait a minute, they don't have the right to do that, I do. We don't like it when our rights are being infringed upon. Rejection, that's a powerful cause for anger. You know the very first place anger is mentioned in the Bible? Genesis 4 has to do with Cain and Abel, two brothers. And we're told that Cain got very angry. Why did Cain get angry? Because God rejected his sacrifice, but he accepted his brother Abel's. And that rejection and that anger comes together. Max Lucado comments, this is the first appearance of anger in the Bible. He'll pop up some 400 more times between here and the maps at the end of the Bible. But this is the first occasion. He pulls up to the curb and gets out of the car, and look who's in the front seat with him. Rejection. Anger and rejection in the same sentence. This isn't the only time the couple are spotted in Scripture. Anger singes many pages, and more than once, rejection is charged with arson. What happens when we feel rejected? We hurt. And when we get hurt, we get hot. Anger becomes a defense mechanism. It's like the classified ad I heard about. It was appeared in a newspaper. It says, new wedding dress, never worn. We'll trade for a 38 caliber pistol. Rejection can lead to anger. Now, what is our anger defending? More often than not, it's defending our pride. Pride feeds anger, and as it grows, anger reinforces pride. And in addition to the frustration we feel when our expectations aren't met, our pride is injured when we're not treated the way we think we should be treated. That injured pride often leads to anger. Anger also appears and arises when we feel that our rights have been threatened. Now, when somebody else gets that privilege or that recognition that we want for ourselves, we get angry because we think that should be ours. But to put our rights before our duty, before loving others, that comes from self-centeredness. See, the truly loving person is more concerned about doing what they should and helping others when they can than in having what they think they should have for themselves. Love considers nothing its rights and everything its obligation. Sometimes we get angry when our personal preferences are challenged. Have you ever noticed two people angry? Taste. You know, maybe it's a music that they like or artwork. Who says, oh, that's a beautiful piece of art. Someone says, that's the ugliest thing I've ever seen. And they argue about it. Really? Does it matter that much? What? We are defending our taste. I have a right to say that's ugly. Yeah, you do. Doesn't mean everybody else has to agree with you. Sometimes our anger comes from there. And interruptions, woof, boy, that's a sore spot. You know, you get that unexpected request, that red light that you know turned red just because you were coming to it. That insensitive idiot that has the nerve to drive the speed limit in front of you. Okay, that's getting personal. See, these are the kinds of things that make us angry, and that's where love comes in and says, no, that's not the right response. So how do we deal with the problem of personal, petty anger? God provides us with the appropriate response to these recurring irritants in our lives. Now, if you're looking for a quick three-step solution to the problem of anger, you're going to be disappointed because there's nothing simple about the problem or the solution. See, it's not enough to deal with the temper. We must go to the source. We must go to our inmost nature. When we deal with the root problem, you see, anger is just a symptom, and it'll take care of itself. Souls are not made sweet by adding sweetness to it. You got to take the acid out. We got to deal with the real problem, and the real problem is self. And the only answer is Jesus. It is only as Jesus Christ comes in, as He takes up residence, as He becomes our life and changes us, transforms us. So I've heard a lot of people say, time will change all things. Time will heal all hurts. No, it doesn't. Only Christ does. Only Christ can heal those hurts. Only Christ can change our hearts. See, as often the case, the heart of the problem is the problem of the heart. And without a heart transformation, any solution is going to be surface and shallow. Christ must come in. And when He does, when He brings that agape love that we've been talking about, it pulls us out of our self-centeredness and it focuses our attention on others and on Himself. And that's the only cure there is. See, genuine love isn't fragile. It has a thick skin. This kind of love applies a lot of grace to every relationship. It leaves room for people to make mistakes and to interrupt our schedules. Love is willing to endure personal slights and insults as Jesus did. True Christian love doesn't become exasperated with people. See, that's always a sign of defeat. When we lose our tempers, we lose everything. You ever heard somebody given a piece of their mind? It's usually a piece they can't afford to lose. Rudyard Kipling said that it was a test of a man if he could keep his head when everyone else was losing theirs. It's true. The man who is the master of his temper can be the master of just about anything. Sometimes the problem comes because our expectations are just too high. Realize you're dealing with other human beings, and they are going to fail. You know, we sing in our hymnal, Jesus never fails. It's the only person we can sing that about. Every other person we know in our lives, they're going to fail. It's going to happen. Don't be so surprised. Sometimes it just takes lowering our expectations a little bit, and that might help us deal with anger. Even in the simple matters of scheduling, leave room for the unexpected. Allow God the latitude to change our direction and our priorities in a given day. Sometimes the best experiences we ever have are those unexpected, those unplanned, even the accidents in our day. We could never have anticipated them, and sometimes those are the greatest blessings God gives. But just remember, love always puts God than more than more than more than more than our things or even our tastes. Love isn't so concerned about personal rejection because we know we're unconditionally accepted by God. And that's what matters most. Love isn't caught up in the personal privileges, plans, or preferences, but it looks to serve God and to help others. In fact, if I could add a word, if I could take the place of the King James translators and add a word to our little phrase today, instead of saying easily provoked, I would say personally provoked. Love is not personally provoked, or maybe selfishly would be better. Love is not selfishly provoked. A big step toward growing in love is taking ourselves a lot less seriously. If we're not careful, though, anger can wreak havoc in our lives. Just think, the word anger is only one little letter away from danger. And anger can often lead us to danger in our lives if we're not careful. As God told Cain, we must master anger or it will master us. The good news, though, is that Jesus says, I will come in and I will master that anger for you if you will let me. Our invitation hymn this morning is hymn number 391. Hymn number 391, this is a very common, typical invitation hymn. But I want you to think of it in the context of what we're talking about today. We're talking today about anger. And oftentimes anger, something we hold on to for a long time. It may be months, it may be years since someone has offended us and we're still angry. As we sing the words to just this first verse, all to Jesus I surrender. Are you willing to surrender your anger today? Are you willing to say, Lord, I'm letting go of it. I am releasing this anger that I'm holding against somebody else. Maybe they really did do me wrong. I'm releasing that anger. I'm not going to hold on to it anymore. It's not worth it. You can find true freedom from that anger and that bitterness. Take this song very personally, very seriously. All to Jesus I surrender. All to Him I freely give. Maybe you've never done that initially. Maybe you've never said to the Lord, I give you my life. You can do that today. Turn over the selfishness that so drives our lives and say, Lord, I want to live for You. I want to know Your love. I want to know Your peace. You can do that this day. We're just going to sing this first verse. If for the first time you say these words, all to Jesus I surrender. Or maybe you're already a believer, but you're saying, I have a lot of anger inside. I want to surrender that anger to Him this day. I want you to meet me here in the front. Let me pray with you. Let's find that liberty and that freedom that comes only through Jesus.